Blog Talk Radio.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to TFT's Blog Talk Radio Show. I have a fascinating guest today. He's a principal in South Florida somewhere. I'll leave it to him to tell you if he chooses. His name's Brian Killeen. I think that's how you pronounce it. Is that right, Brian?
Killeen, that's close enough.
Okay.
I've been called a lot worse, let me tell you.
Oh, me too. Well, Brian and I met on Twitter, as I meet lots of people, talking about education and the reform movement and all kinds of stuff. And Brian, I think, was not necessarily Mr. Online blogger Twitter crazy man, but he's been sucked in, and I guess now you have a blog that the first piece you did was widely spread around the internet, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I was actually very surprised by my first try.
So before we get in, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say it was an exercise in frustration after I had received some news about the state scoring system and the impact that it was going to have on my school. So I believe that there are a lot of people out there who feel similarly.
I have a feeling you're right. So before we get into all that, why don't you just tell everybody who you are and any information you want them to know about you so they kind of know where you're coming from. And any, if, you know, your website, you can plug it, and so on. So go ahead, tell people who you are.
Again, I'm Brian Killeen. I'm the principal at Highland Elementary in Lake Worth, Florida. And we have a very, very unique school in that we have a population of students who are mainly from Guatemala. Their native language is not Spanish, but it's Conobal for the most part. We have a couple of true speakers, and I think we have one Quiche family in the area, but they may have moved out of our school. We have a lot of other students from Central America who do speak Spanish, but the larger population is from Guatemala. Our second largest group of students is from Haiti. So even though they're Haitian Creole and now even Conobal is written, the kids who come to my school and their families have never seen the written word by the time they get to us. So it's a unique challenge. 99% of our kids are on free and reduced lunch, and we have the second highest homeless population in Palm Beach County. And people who aren't familiar with Palm Beach think, so, well, Palm Beach is a rich area, but Palm Beach County is a huge, huge county. It goes from the Atlantic Ocean all the way into the Everglades, so you have pockets of great wealth, but you have also pockets of extremely, extremely poor conditions. And we're in one of those pockets where, you know, when the economy goes south, we get a lot of homeless people coming into our area. And that's why, because we have a homeless shelter down the street, and we have transition housing, and we have low-income housing in the neighborhood. So it's a unique challenge for my faculty, staff, and I.
So when Romney says that we have services to take care of the poor, that homeless shelter and those transitional services down the street from your school is what he's talking about?
yeah, that's our safety net. I'm sure that they feel that they have a safety net there. But I actually have to say that the people, we work closely with those folks, and they're fantastic people. And they, with the amount of money that they have, you know, what they do for our kids and our families is amazing, but, you know, I prefer not to talk too much about Romney and give him credit for anything, because that comment was kind of a moronic statement.
Well, yeah, that's kind of my point. It seems that, you know, the absolute leanest program, getting leaner and leaner and leaner, are the programs that we have for helping our, you know, incredibly impoverished populations. And, you know, you're on the front lines right there. Is it your impression that the services we as America offer these people, are they enough?
Oh, not by a long shot. And I think the biggest problem is that, at least for my kids and my families, is that they're really not aware of what is available to them, and as little as that is, you know. But it can never be enough. I don't think you can say to a homeless family, "I'm going to put you in an apartment that's temporary until we find some transition housing, until we find some other types of housing." You know, when they're that unstable, I don't think no matter what you say or what you do for them, it can be enough. What I will say, and again, I have the utmost regard for both the people who work with my families, but for my families as well, because, you know, they bring their kids to school every day. You know, they want to do what's best for their kids under the worst of situations. The thing that we're seeing, we had the Guatemalan population had been there for a long time. This year is the first year I've actually seen enough white students where when I walk into the classes that I have, I used to see maybe one or two white students throughout the entire school. Now I could see some in every grade level. In most of our classrooms, we have more African Americans or American blacks in our school. We had blacks, but they were mainly Haitian Creole, and you know, it's quite a different culture for
right.
that. But you know, again, when the economy it really took a bad turn over the last few years, obviously we've you know gotten more students there, and ironically, it's actually good for us because it raises our test scores because we have more American speakers. But when my teachers were mentioning earlier in the year how some of our parents were kind of mean toward them, and I said, you know, just keep an understanding of where these folks are coming from. They've had their homes taken away from them. They've been ripped out of their own lives and kind of thrown at us. And so many of them are just angry, and they expect mm-hmm. that because we're in a bad neighborhood, or I wouldn't say a bad neighborhood, but a low-income neighborhood, that, you know, we're not a good school. And then once they get here and they come to our school and they see what our teachers do and the things that we do for our families, you know, they have a whole different perspective over it. So the anger subsides, at least against us, a little bit. And then we can work together to not only help their kids, but we also have things in place to help them maybe get back on their feet again.
Okay. We do have a caller online. A caller, area code 219, you're on the air. Caller? The caller went away.
Okay.
All right. So it sounds to me that last bit you just mentioned, that people are that yours is a failing school, and then when they get there, they realize it's not. Why do they have that impression in the first place?
Well, we have a school grading system that measures our schools based on test scores. And, again, we struggle with test scores because we have a challenging population. But, you know, I am so proud of what my teachers do. We had a grade of C, which obviously is not great, but it's not terrible. But, you know, many of these folks are coming from schools that had grades of B and A. You know, but what I see, and I wrote this in one of my blogs, you know, I tell anyone, I challenge anyone to come to our school and look at what our kids are doing and look at what our teachers are doing and the high-level work that they're doing. To get students who speak Kanhobá, and then they have to learn Kanhobá, then they go to Spanish, then to English. To get them to the point where they're performing as they do is really, really an amazing feat. And I have the teachers are very caring, and that's another thing that the parents notice right away, is that the teachers really go out of the way, you know, to take care of our kids. And as I said, we have some things in place at our school, attached to our school, a thing called the Bridges Center, that helps not just the families, or not just the kids, but the families as far as getting services that they need and a host of other things that we do for them in the field of education.
So it sounds like, just like Jeffrey Canada's Harlem Children's Zone, if you can offer this population more than just the greatest teachers on earth, but wraparound services, that's going to make the difference. In other words, it sounds to me like it's less a factor of great teachers and more a factor of these wraparound services and things like that. Would that be accurate?
I would say it's a combination of both because I joke with my teachers about this because I brag about them often to the point where people run away from me, you know, because they are, without their support, the program that we have wouldn't be in existence. I mean, we started, this has been a long time coming, but, you know, we started talking about doing these things 7 years ago. And, you know, it's the faculty and staff has got to support what we're doing in order for this to go on, and they continue to support it. When we have families in crises, or in crisis, they will refer them to this Bridges Center, and then the Bridges Center will do what, you know, will provide the services. And they actually don't provide the services. What we do is we sit down with the families and we take all of their information, and then we have a computer program that we plug into that tells us all the services that are available to them, and then we refer them to these services. We do the follow-up. We do some things on campus as far as the education goes. We have a mentoring center there. We have a pre-K program that goes I jokingly call it my birth-to-death program, you know, our birth-to-death program, because what we do is we have a group of folks that go into homes when we know a child is about to be born to a family, and you know, work with the families as far as prenatal and postnatal care. We work with the families as far as what the children need to know in their first year of life and their second year of life. And then we started a two-year-old classroom. We had the first two-year-old classroom in Palm Beach County. And then I want to expand all these programs, but it's a start. And then we also have a three-year-old and two four-year-old classrooms. And then we bring those kids into our school. So if the parents are to participate in this, though, they also must participate seven times each semester in something at the school. And that is a big piece of it because with our families, you know, they've been persecuted in their homelands, and that because things are not going well in their homelands. And there's not a whole lot of trust in a governmental agency, which is what we are. It took a long time to build this up. And so to get them to come into school, they all of a sudden now notice that the school isn't something that's bad for them. It's actually good for them and their families.
Let me ask you, how on earth do you fund that thing?
That's the question of the hour. We actually wrote a grant. We have an organization here in Florida, in most counties in Florida, I think if not all, called Children's Services Council. Ours is very, very active. And when I started looking into, because one of the first things I knew is that if our kids are going to have any chance at all in doing well and playing on an even playing field, we had to deal with early education. And as I was doing it, this Children's Services Council was looking for a school to basically do a birth to 5-year-old program. And so we were talking about the same things at the same time, and we, you know, acquaintances hooked us up together. And from those discussions, we worked on getting grants and things like that. We got a grant from the federal government that's 5 years. That's a 5-year grant. It's about to expire. So the big challenge is then looking for funding streams to keep us going, which we've done semi-successfully. We still probably need to do a little bit more, but you know, we are ready to move on without the grant, I think, for the most part.
Wow. Now, one of the big complaints about things like the Harlem Children's Zone and charters in general is scalability. And what you're talking about, I think, probably would be considered something that is difficult to scale up. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's probably the biggest problem because of the lack of funding. You know, I have space on campus, and I have plans. I've actually drawn out plans that the school district has actually approved. And the thing that is great, but not great about it, is the school district is all in our favor, but we have to run we have to get the funds for it. So, just if I were to build, I want to keep it simple so that we can scale up. So what I want to do is get a set of portable or concretables we have on our on our campus so that we can do both the adult, because we also have an adult ed program that our parents are involved with too. To do the adult ed program and the pre-K program, it costs about $50,000 to get one of those one portable on campus, and then it's a matter of keeping it running and funding the teachers and the, you know, the equipment and everything else that you need to do.
Right. I'm talking about, you know, scaling it up nationally. Is it even possible?
Well, I to be honest, I think we have to. I mean, if we're going to really address the needs of our low-income folks, it's a Band-Aid by throwing a lot of money at even third, fourth, and fifth grade students, you know, because by that, if we don't have the kids up to speed by the end of first grade, I mean, there's a ton of studies out there that show that if a student's not reading at grade level by the end of first grade, 80% of those students who are at that point never meet grade level. So if we don't do it, we're going to have some big problems. And so when I hear people talk about education reform and they talk about this ridiculous testing nonsense that we're going through, you know, they're not even scratching the surface of what we really need to do. We need to address the needs of our kids before they walk into kindergarten. Because, again, they talk about kids in high-poverty neighborhoods who have such language deficiencies walking in the door that it's very difficult to get them to catch up. Well, there's one way to get them to catch up, and that is to help them by giving them that early childhood education. And the thing that's interesting about this is I've been a high school, middle school, a secondary person my entire life until I got this job. And the more I see this, and I used to think that you needed to put in money in the middle school and the high school and really prepare kids for their futures and their careers and everything else. And I think those things are important. But you know what? You're throwing a lot of money out the window unless you get those kids ready to roll out of elementary school.
So my whole career was spent in an elementary school. And it's just so fascinating to hear you say that, because from a elementary teacher's perspective, we know that we send you kids who were damaged, you know, 0 to 3, and we couldn't do much to ameliorate that damage. We do our best. We send them along, but we failed the minute they walked into our room, because from 0 to 3, they weren't getting what they needed. One of my big pushes is to get universal health care and universal high-quality early childhood education. I mean, it seems to me right now we entrust our 0 to 3-year-olds with minimum wage employees. And I don't mean to diss those employees, but I do mean to say that if we hired credentialed teachers to do our early childhood education, I think we might get a better result. And what you're saying is that if we don't focus on these kids early, like 0 to 3, we've kind of already missed our chance.
Right. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I never would have believed it until I got to this school and saw the challenges, because the challenges are more pronounced here because, you know, we just talked about the statistics, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, regarding the language deficits for students of that are raised in poverty. But then our kids are raised in poverty, and they have a natural language deficiency simply because their home language is Kamilbala, and it's only recently written. And the same thing for my Creole speakers. So it's... You know, it kind of hits you in the head. You can't miss it. And that's why I'm not a genius. It's just something that, you know, this is something that has to be done. And if we don't do this, if we don't change the paradigm by which we are working, we're going to be banging our heads against the wall forever. We're going to be talking, you know, they talk about upping the ante, and they're doing this in Florida now, which is why I'm really frustrated. They're making it tougher to pass tests. They're making the test tougher. They're doing things that they think is going to actually do something to help our kids become better students. And all that's doing is adding frustration to our kids, to our teachers, and everything else. We have to address this issue before our kids walk into kindergarten, and until people on the money's there to do it. There's a lot of money being thrown around out there at the wrong things, at this testing nonsense, for instance. That's a waste of money. And don't get me wrong. I will say this. I believe testing is valuable. I believe it's important for me to be able to see where my kids are so that it can help me, my teachers, the faculty and staff, decide what our instructional strategies and practices are going to be. But it shouldn't be used as a hammer over schools to get your kids to perform better. It just doesn't work that way.
Let me ask you a question as a principal. You just said that you find the data valuable, and I'm sure that's true. In terms of percentage of things you value when making decisions about instruction and so on, things that you use that test information for, how much of that test information actually goes into your decision? Is it a huge part, a small part? You know, what? How much?
I would say that because of our again, I'm not a saint, because of our testing situation, it's probably larger than it is. However, our faculty and staff they take, for instance, anecdotal notes as part of our evaluation system. We look at mini assessments as part of our evaluation system. We look at classroom performance. No single piece of information is something that's going to drive our decision. So when I say testing, I'm not just talking, I should say assessment instead of testing, right? But I do think that the test has some value to what we're doing. But is it the be-all and end-all? Of course, that's a ridiculous thought, which is why it's ridiculous to have these state grading systems and NCLB and Race to the Top and all this other nonsense based on testing. You know, every piece of data that you can get from a classroom, I could look at a teacher's grade book, or a teacher can tell me the level of a kid before we even hit that test. I already know what the level of the kid is. Now, the test might be able to tell me specific areas in which students are in need. And so I look at the test for trend data. I mean, is this something that we are doing as a school? Are there practices that we need to improve upon? I mean, I don't look at anything to say, you know, that any you know, large, vague number.
I get you. I was in a faculty meeting once, and our district data person came in with a graph that had a year's worth of data, one academic year, and the title of the graph was Trend Data. And I remember some of us looking at each other in amazement, trying to figure out how on earth she could be displaying a graph with 1 year of data and calling it a trend.
Right.
It's my experience that district directives cause people like that lady to be sent into faculty meetings at various school sites within the district and present what is obviously pure nonsense. That they attempt to cloak in you know, they call it data. Have you had that experience coming down from your bosses as an administrator?
I would say our district is pretty advanced as far as it comes to data, and so I've never had that experience as far as that's concerned. I actually worked as a district administrator. I am now considered a reformed district administrator, but I worked in that position before. And my job was to take all. I was in charge of what they call student progression in Palm Beach County, and my job was to take all of the state laws and federal laws, district mandates, state mandates, anything that was passed that impacts students, and find a way to implement it. So I was the person that had to bring the bad news to all the schools, and I really feel for that person who came in with that ridiculous set of data that you were supposed to look at as far as trends are concerned. But as far as our district is concerned, you know, we're the people who run our data are pretty sophisticated as far as that's concerned, and in some ways I think they lead the state. And you know, I'm not trying to blow their horn because I'm not always I wasn't pleased with them today. As an example, we were in a district meeting, but you know, the fact is that I don't think they would ever send someone to us that ill prepared. Whether it was them sending it to us or allowing someone to come on their own that way. So I think they know what trend that is. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm perfectly willing to stipulate that there are districts out there that don't have sycophants that would do such a thing.
Right. Oh, I think people will do it. I'm not saying that won't happen. If the district said to come down and do that, you know, someone would do it. But, you know, the point is, I think that our district is at a point now when it comes to looking at data that they're a little bit more sophisticated than what you're describing to me. All right.
Yeah,
so, but, you know, we get data, I don't want to say jammed down our throat, but we see data. Our whole district does diagnostic assessments twice a year before our state assessment is concerned. And a diagnostic assessment is a short version of our state assessment. And then we break it down into different areas of whatever the content area is. So we can take a look at those types of things. I mean, there's a million things that we look at. So,
you can't look at, kids are just not a narrow measure. There's a billion things impacting a kid. So you got to look at them all, right?
Right.
We only have about 4 minutes left. There's a bunch of people in the chat room. If anybody wants to call in, we're still going to go for another 15 minutes if we want to, even though we'll be off the air in about 3.5 minutes. But if you want to call in, the call-in number is 619-996-1651. Okay, sorry, Brian, go ahead.
That's okay. That went very fast.
Yeah, it did. That's why I'm trying to raise money to get the premium account here on Blog Talk Radio, because then I would be able to do 2-hour shows and I would be able to do them in prime time. So any of you listening out there, go to my blog, www.thefrustratedteacher.com, find the donate button. If you donate $50, I'll send you a TFT thong. Donate $100, I'll send you a TFT mug, both worth nearly $6. Send me a whole lot and I'll let you co-host the show one day. You know, let's go, people. I got Brian to come on. I had Steve crashing the other day. I'm getting kids to come on. This could be huge. All right, anyhow, that's my plan. So Brian, you are a principal of an elementary school, and in your faculty meetings, you guys do peruse data. Let me ask you, when it comes down to a kid who is struggling because of emotional issues, you know, they're not cognitively delayed or anything, they're just messed up because their life's a disaster.
Right.
Is there any amount of data that you can look at and peruse that will give you any insights how to deal with that kid? In other words, is that kid's issue a matter of science, the science of teaching, or is it a matter of the art of teaching? Oh, Brian, hold on. We have a caller, and before we go off the air, let's just take this caller.
Okay.
Caller, area code 561, I think you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm a resident of the state of Florida, and I saw Mr. Killeen's initial Facebook data presentation or whatever. I'm curious if that was passed on to anyone higher up than himself, and the response that he got to it. His data showed the predicted effects of what the legislature was proposing as far as changing the school grade and its effects on the school's type populations of children at risk.
You kind of broke up, but from what I gathered, the question was, did that blog get sent up to anyone higher than me in the district office?
Yes, and did anything come out of it?
To be honest, my wife's been bugging me to do that, and I haven't done it yet. The reason I haven't is that by the time I finished posting it, the state had already made their decision as far as what they were doing. So I just figured it would have been not a waste of time, but it wouldn't have had any impact.
Yeah.
But
problem.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just saying the timing was a bit of a problem, huh?
She said the timing. the timing was a bit of a problem.
But you know what? The timing was a problem as far as having someone from our district, because we do have lobbyists for our district, and all the districts do, and the superintendents have lobbied with the state to not pass those rules. However, I don't think there's any bad time to inform people, so it will get to my superiors. I may be back in the classroom the next day, but I like teaching, so that won't be such a terrible thing.
Thank you.
Good
for
you,
out, because what you say needs to be said in the state of Florida.
Thank you.
Thank you, caller.
I will certainly put the word out.
Awesome. All right, so technically we're off the air, but
okay.
But we're recording for another 15 minutes or so. So I asked you that question about science or art.
Science. Well, I think in the case of an emotional, you were talking about a student who's got some emotional issues, and we have many of them. And to me, I think they both come in hand, but at first the art of teaching is where you can discern basically whether this child is just struggling because he's struggling or struggling because there are other things going on in the child's lives. And again, with our teachers, I talk with people who come to visit our school because when they see our statistics and our data and the things that we're talking, they're amazed at our school because they see our kids are smiling and they seem so happy. But when you're in the classroom with the kids all the time, that's not always the case. And when the home life gets really rough, you know, it really manifests itself within the individual classrooms, and the teachers who know them best are the ones who've got to figure out, you know, what is happening here and why is this child struggling, and, you know, what is it that I need to do. Now, sometimes as far as the data is concerned, and I'm talking about anecdotal data, I'm talking about all kinds of things. I'm going to give you an example of a child that we just dealt with this week. This young man transferred to our school. He's been like beating on everybody he can get his hands on. And he's a bright, bright kid. He's a second grader. He reads at a very, very high level. He might be a little ADHD. He's also really struggling emotionally. I think the upheaval of coming to our area, our school, I'm not sure if there's other things involved at home, but the people in the classrooms know a little bit more. I had this young man visit me every day, and we talk every day before he goes to school, before he goes into the classroom, so we try to get him on the right track. The teacher figured out through some of the strategies she was using in the classroom that this young man loves to draw and will write as much as you want as long as he's writing about what he's drawing. And so this kid who reads at a high level but couldn't really produce in any other area, if you let him draw, he'll do math, you know, and he'll do some drawing about the math that he's doing. I mean, this kid's really bright. But the fact is that the teacher realized that this child needed something different, and so she followed him around, like she does with all of our kids, but was taking notes, and then all of a sudden realized that every time this child had to draw something, he performed. And this is something that no test by itself is going to do, but this lady, one, kept an eye out for this because she knew this child was struggling. She knew he was bright and had the ability, but he wasn't doing anything in the classroom. Now she found that thing that's going to click for this young man. And how long this was going to last, I don't know, but the fact is that was, to me, the art of teaching. All right, the science of teaching is now that we know that for the time period that he didn't do his work, he's fallen behind. So we will do some mini assessments, things like that, to figure out where we're going to be able to catch him up, or how we're going to, but because he's bright, I think we're going to be able to do that. And
right.
Not just bright, but he came in reading at a higher level. So are you
telling me that there is no magical pedagogy, no fantastic curricular materials? There's nothing that we can just, you know, script that's going to help this kid? You actually have to have a human being interact with him in order to do that?
Is that sarcasm I hear?
Oh yeah, because that your description right there is just so. It's exactly what the Bill Gates of the world, and even the Michelle Reeves of the world, who just didn't spend enough time in a classroom, it's what they don't know. It's what they don't see. It's what they miss. So everything you just said is, you know, how to deal with this child is predicated first, its basis is in the relationship between the teacher and the student, having nothing to do with that teacher's education or style or anything. It has to do with an interpersonal relationship between a teacher and a student, and nothing follows unless that seems solid. And it sounds to me like you're the principal, one of the few who knows that and who makes that happen at a school, and I mean, that's what I'm hearing. Is that what you do? Is that what you value?
Well, I do value that very much. I said from the day I first entered this school that, you know, next to the children, our teachers are the most important people in the school. And that counts me. And my personal hierarchy for decision-making is, you know, kids first, then teachers and family are they're neck and neck as far as that's concerned. And then then the administrative staff and the rest of the staff, and then me. You know, so, and I challenge the teachers. I tell them, I don't really need to anymore, but when I first got there, I would say, look, if you think I break that hierarchy, you come and talk to me about it. Because, you know, having been a teacher, I value teachers. And I taught for a long time. I was a long-time teacher for about 16 years prior to going into administration. And I still consider myself to be a teacher first and foremost. And so, you know, if that's how I feel about myself as a teacher, as an educator, you know, I need to value the people who are the ones that are really on the front line, you know, because the teachers are the ones.
Right.
And I'm hoping that you're wrong about the principal thing. I have some very, very good colleagues who I believe feel the same way. I sure hope so anyway.
I didn't mean to imply that principals all suck.
No,
clearly
I know.
They don't.
I know.
But you brought up something important. You taught for 16 years. Is it your contention that all principals should have a certain minimum number of years in the classroom before they can become an administrator or principal?
I feel more comfortable with that, but I think just like there's no set formula for great principals, I think being in the classroom for having the classroom experience is a successful classroom experience. And when I say successful, I'm not talking about, yeah, my kids did well on tests. I mean, were you able to have your kids develop as people? Were you able to move them from where they were when they walked in your door? Did they grow a year's worth of growth? And I mean in every aspect. In a year's time, you know, did they mature a year? Are they ready to move on to the next step? That's my job. I felt as a teacher, as much as it was to I was a history teacher, as much as it was to teach about, you know, American history, you know, that was a part of my job, and it was important because it enabled them to move on to college and so forth. But it wasn't the most important thing for me, and I think that where it was maybe about equally important. Let's put it that way. And I think that that's what we should look for in principals and administrators, people who have the knowledge of what should be happening in the classroom and the empathy for it because they've done it. But I don't know that there's a set number. I don't know that you could say, I know some people who've been in the classroom for 10 years and could never be a great administrator because, you know, when they close that door, it's them and their kids and that's it. And they're very good teachers, but they would never be administrators because you have to have a more global perspective. I know people who, I have a couple of friends who've been in the classroom a minimal time and I think are very, very good administrators. I think you're better if you've been a teacher first. And I think you're better if you've been, because I know some who have been guidance counselors, and I don't think they're quite as effective. I think that if they were a guidance counselor after being in the classroom for a while, yeah. So there's no magic number. I'd hate to see them put a number on that, but I certainly think that experience is necessary, no doubt.
Okay. I agree with you completely. I mean, I've had my last principal had been a middle school English teacher for 10 years, and then she became an elementary principal. And most of us teachers, basically after the first couple of years with her, decided she just really didn't get little kids.
Right.
And so we felt that was this poor principal had all kinds of parent complaints and all kinds of stuff. So it really was sort of a disaster. And I do kind of feel that, you know, she was a bad fit because she couldn't deal with little kids. You know, she seemed
right.
even uncomfortable around them. And there's just no way that can work.
I'll tell you what, you know, I mentioned earlier that I had been secondary my entire life, and I had no interest in being an elementary principal. The reason I got to this school was because when we were talking about schools, I actually worked a lot with our superintendent, and I was ready, you know, the decision had been made to make me a principal, and they were talking to me about being schools in secondary schools that were in, more well-to-do neighborhoods. And I basically said to him, I don't want to go to a school like that. I want to go to a school where I'm going to have an impact every single day. And you know, it's not a matter of dealing with parent complaints. It's a matter of dealing with, you know, really day-to-day life-threatening issues and so forth. I don't know if I like threatening is what I want, the way to put that. But, you know, and he basically said, there's one opening, and it's an elementary school, and you got it. You know, so, you know, I wanted a Title I school. I wanted a school where I felt like it had an impact.
And
so
you
I ended up here. Yeah, and I was worried because I had always joked about the fact that, you know, these got these little gnats around me, you know. So, but now that I've been there, I was surprised from the minute I walked in the door how much I enjoyed it, and how I like the secondary kids as well. I coach and I do other things, so I enjoy those kids as well. But I really, really love what I'm doing, and it's been a real eye-opening experience for me. And you know, every day is a great day. I tell my faculty that every day I go to work with a smile. I don't always go home that way, but I always go to work with a smile because I know that I'm coming to a great group of kids and I'm coming to a great group of professionals as well.
Yeah, I worked for a little bit with older kids, but my classroom career was basically K and second grade. And I can just say that, you know, those smiling, innocent faces full of curiosity, just waiting to learn stuff is, you know, when you get in front of those kids, you are compelled to just explain things to them because they receive it so readily. It really was the most exciting time of my life. I kind of miss being out of a classroom now. I really do.
Yeah. You sound a lot like a teacher that I have, who's one of our first grade teachers. He taught mostly middle school and intermediate kids, but I have him in a first grade classroom right now, and he talks about that experience the way you're talking about your second grade class. It's really kind of fun to hear you talk about it, but also when he talks about it, he's so excited about the learning that he's actually seeing in his classroom. It's a blast.
Yeah, because I think you do. With little kids, you get to see the fruits of your labor a little easier, I think, than with older kids, because they come sort of frequently. You know, the older kids, you got a much more in-depth, abstract something you're trying to teach, and it's going to take a while. Little kids, they
right.
might get something, you know, 5 minutes from now. They got it. Let's move on to something
right.
new.
That's right.
We're down to our last minute.
Okay.
Just so you know.
Okay. I was just saying that sometimes with the older kids, you don't know until years later what kind of an impact you had on them. But you're right, with the little kids, it's much more immediate.
Yeah, yeah. All right, I think on that note of loveliness, we should leave it.
Okay.
So
I'm gonna just say,
Brian, thank you so much. It was a really, really good talk, informative. You even got to give a little info to a Florida local who called
yeah.
in. So I'm going to invite you back at some point, I suppose. Keep your ears peeled. Listeners, go check out Brian Killeen, just like that, on Twitter. I'll have links on the Blog Talk Radio page and stuff. So, again, Brian, thanks so much for coming, and we'll talk soon. Thank you.
My pleasure. Take care. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye. And there you have TFT's interview of Florida principal Brian Killeen. What an awesome guy. I would have loved to have worked for a principal like that. Wow. All right, ladies and gentlemen, next one coming up is Gideon Stein on the 9th.